December 31st, 2010, Wilmington, Delaware. The body of 66-year-old Jack Wheeler is discovered in a trash heap at a landfill, and his cause of death is determined to be blunt force trauma. Days earlier, Jack had left his residence in New York City to travel to Delaware, and numerous eyewitnesses report seeing Jack wander through the area and displaying erratic behavior, which may have been brought on by his struggles with bipolar disorder. It is believed that Jack's body was transported to the landfill after he wound up inside a dumpster which was picked up by a garbage truck, but even though investigators believe his injuries are consistent with a homicide, the exact circumstances of how Jack died remain unclear. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and on today's episode, we're going to be exploring the case which was the subject of Episode 1 of the second season of the Unsolved Mysteries reboot on Netflix, the unexplained 2010 death of Jack Wheeler. The victim in this story led a particularly interesting life, as he served as a White House aide for no less than 3 U.S. presidents and was involved in a number of impressive achievements, including the creation of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. But unfortunately, Jack's life would end in a very tragic fashion, as his body was discovered in a landfill in Delaware after he had spent the past few days frequenting a variety of different locations doing a number of things which did not seem to make much logical sense. Now, before this case was even featured on Unsolved Mysteries, I had actually received a couple of requests to cover it on The Trail Went Cold, and while my knowledge about the story was limited, I did know that Jack's death had officially been ruled a homicide, and because of his government connections, there were a number of conspiracy theories surrounding his death. However, once the Unsolved Mysteries episode came out, the consensus from many viewers seemed to be that Jack was the victim of a tragic accident brought on by his struggles with bipolar disorder, and while the episode did acknowledge Jack's mental health issues, it has received some criticism for its handling of the subject. Much like their episode about the death of Ray Rivera, the Unsolved Mysteries reboot has been accused of leaving out key details to craft a narrative and make their stories appear as mysterious as possible, even though there's a chance that no crime ever took place. To be quite honest, this was one of the main reasons I was reluctant to cover Jack Wheeler's story on The Trail Went Cold, but I do have to acknowledge that in spite of the skepticism from online sleuths, Jack's death was officially ruled to be a homicide by the medical examiner and law enforcement. The most commonly proposed theory is that he was killed by the trash compactor in the garbage truck which picked up the dumpster containing Jack's body, but investigators do seem to believe that his injuries were more consistent with a beating. So I ultimately thought it would be important to present the most well-rounded account of Jack Wheeler's death that I could, as this is an opportunity to explore the topic of how mental illness can sometimes be downplayed in cold case investigations. Oh, and I also wanted to cover this once I realized that I have technically never done a Trail Went Cold episode about a case from the state of Delaware. Yes, I once covered the death of Jonathan Luna, who spent some time driving through Delaware before he was found dead in Pennsylvania, but since Delaware is one of only 2 states, the other being Utah, I have yet to do a full case from, I thought this was long overdue. And yes, I will be covering something from Utah in the near future so they don't feel left out. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the death of Jack Wheeler.
Thank you.
Our story begins in 2010, and our central figure is 66-year-old John Parsons Wheeler III, who goes by the name Jack. Originally born in Laredo, Texas, Jack hailed from a family with an extensive military history, and he arrived while his father, John Parsons Wheeler II, nicknamed Big Jack, was fighting overseas in World War II. In fact, only 5 days after Jack's birth, his family actually received a telegram that Big Jack had gone missing in action during the Battle of the Bulge. Thankfully, Big Jack was later found to be alive, and after receiving the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart, he would continue on with a military career which lasted over 30 years, reaching the rank of U.S. Army Colonel. Jack decided to follow in his father's footsteps by joining the United States Military Academy at West Point, and after graduating near the top of his class in 1966, he went to Vietnam and served in a non-combat administrative position at Long Binh Post, where he worked at computerizing army operations. However, Jack was hit hard by the fact that a number of people he knew at West Point lost their lives during the Vietnam War, as 10% of his graduating class were killed in action. In fact, the experiences of Jack and his West Point classmates would be chronicled in the 1989 book, The Long Gray Line, The American Journey of West Point's Class of 1966, which was authored by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Rick Atkinson. Following his return from Vietnam, Jack served on the general staff at the Pentagon and went on to have a successful career in the private sector, but by 1979, he decided to become chairman of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund. The nonprofit organization had been established by a Vietnam veteran named Jan Scruggs, and eventually paved the way for the creation of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial 3 years later, which would be built in Washington, D.C., and feature the names of every service member who lost their life during the war. Over the next 3 decades, Jack would keep himself busy by working for the government and becoming the CEO of such nonprofit organizations as Mothers Against Drunk Driving and the Vietnam Children's Fund. He served as a White House aide to Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, working on the latter's transition team when he entered office, and during George W. Bush's second term as president, Jack served as special assistant to the Secretary of the Air Force. By 2010, Jack had become a very influential figure among Washington's elite, who had many prominent friends, and by this point, he was now working as a national security consultant to the nonprofit research and development firm, the Meter Corporation, assisting them with cybersecurity issues. However, in spite of Jack's personal achievements, he had lifelong struggles with depression and bipolar disorder, and took medication to control his condition. For the past 13 years, Jack had been married to his second wife, Catherine Kleiss, and he had a twin son and daughter from his first marriage, as well as 2 stepchildren from Catherine's first marriage. Jack and Catherine were now splitting their time living in 2 separate residences, a condo in the Harlem neighborhood of New York City, and a getaway home in the town of Newcastle, Delaware. On Christmas Eve, Jack took an Amtrak train from Newcastle to Harlem to spend the holidays with his family, but on December the 28th, he decided to leave and hop on a train to Washington, D.C. Jack told Catherine he was planning to spend a few days there doing some work for the Meter Corporation, but she was not thrilled with his decision, as she hoped Jack would spend the rest of the holidays with her until the new year. The couple got into a heated argument, but Jack still left on his train trip as planned, and spent most of the day using his phone to remain in contact with Catherine and other members of his family through emails and text messages. But even though it would be established that Jack arrived in Washington and spent part of the day there, he eventually decided to hop on another train and make an unexplained trip to Wilmington, Delaware. Wilmington is only 6 miles north from Newcastle, the location of Jack's second home, and shortly after 11:30 p.m., Jack's next-door neighbor, Scott Morris, heard an odd sound outside his residence. When Morris looked out the window, he claimed that he saw the darkened silhouette of a man standing in the frame of a 3-story house across the street, which was under construction at the time. After the man walked away, Morris noticed that there was smoke coming from the house, so he phoned the police and the fire department. But when the authorities arrived, they discovered that the structure was not actually on fire, as someone had tossed some smoke bombs into it, causing very little damage. However, a cell phone was eventually found at the scene, and it was identified as belonging to Jack Wheeler. Indeed, Jack's residence was located across the street from the house which was under construction, and he had spent a lot of time and energy organizing petitions and filing legal challenges in order to prevent it. Jack was unhappy that the house was going to block his view of the Delaware River and opposed any construction on that particular piece of land, as he felt it had historical significance since William Penn had taken his first step on American soil there in 1682. While Jack had attempted to file a temporary restraining order against construction of the house, a Delaware Court of Chancery judge had denied Jack's request just over 2 weeks earlier on December the 13th. The incident with the smoke bombs was particularly interesting, since Jack was known to own smoke bombs, which he would use to get rid of rodents in his garden. The following morning at 8:45 a.m., Jack hailed a cab from the Amtrak station in Wilmington to the Hotel DuPont, though it's unclear why he decided to visit this location, since records would show he never registered there. But about 45 minutes later, Jack sent an email to the Meter Corporation to inform them that his home had been burglarized and a number of his personal items, including a cell phone, briefcase, wallet, identification badge, and key fob, had been stolen. He also sent an email to his daughter and another one to his therapist to say that he felt, quote-unquote, dazed, boxed in a corner, following his most recent fight with Catherine. Since Jack no longer had his cell phone in his possession by this point, it's never been made clear to me where exactly he sent those emails from, and even though he told his employer that he had been burglarized, Jack never attempted to report the incident to the police. Jack's whereabouts for the next several hours are unknown, but at around 6 p.m., he walked into a Happy Harry's pharmacy in Newcastle, located just a few blocks from his residence. Jack's presence there was captured by the security cameras, and the pharmacist immediately recognized him since he was a regular customer who often had his prescriptions filled there. Even though it was a very cold night, Jack was only dressed in a suit jacket and did not have an overcoat. According to the pharmacist, Jack, who looked visibly upset, asked for a ride to Wilmington. Since the pharmacist couldn't leave the establishment, he offered to call Jack a cab, but even though Jack declined, he managed to convince a couple there to give him a ride before they left together. Well, about 40 minutes later, security camera footage would capture Jack walking through the parking garage attached to the Newcastle County Courthouse in Wilmington. He was walking around with what appeared to be a limp, and was carrying his right shoe in his left hand, and his body language seemed to indicate that he was disoriented and agitated. When Jack spoke to the parking attendant on duty, he told her that he had been robbed, and that his briefcase, which contained his parking ticket, had been stolen. He also said that he could not find his car, but in actuality, Jack had actually left his car at an entirely different parking garage at the Amtrak train station 3 blocks away. Jack had originally been parked there when he arrived in Newcastle 1 week earlier, before he took the train to New York on Christmas Eve to see his family. A security guard from the courthouse was summoned down to the parking garage to speak with Jack, and would later say that his eyes were red, as if he had been recently crying. In spite of this, the guard said that Jack did not smell of alcohol, and his speech was not slurred, and when a state employee offered Jack money to get home, he declined and said that he already had enough money on him. Jack soon left the parking garage, and since the next confirmed sighting of him would not take place until the following morning, it's unclear where he spent the night. At around 8 a.m. on the morning of December the 30th, Jack was seen buying coffee at a Subway sandwich shop, and the owner would later describe him as looking like a homeless person, as he was no longer wearing a sport coat and had on a dress shirt which was filthy from the elbow down. Later that day, Jack was seen wandering through the lobby of the high-rise office building, the Nemours Building, and even though multiple people asked him if he needed help, Jack declined. He eventually made it to the 10th floor and visited the law firm Connolly, Bove, Lodge & Hutz, where he asked to speak with a managing partner. While the receptionist left her desk to go find someone, Jack left before she returned. Jack also paid a visit to a small business administration office on the 11th floor to ask for a ride to Philadelphia for unknown reasons. At 3:26 p.m., security cameras captured Jack wandering around the Nemours Building's basement, and later that night, surveillance footage showed him exiting the building, and he was now wearing a dark hooded sweatshirt which his family believed did not belong to him, and it was pulled up over his head in an attempt to cover his face. At 8:42 p.m., a security camera outside the Hotel DuPont showed Jack walking east towards Rodney Square, but what happened to him next remains a mystery. Well, earlier that day, one of Jack's neighbors in Newcastle, Robert Dill, who functioned as a caretaker for the Wheeler residence when they were out of town, noticed that one of the house's upstairs rear windows was open. When Dill went over to the house, he discovered that a side door was open, so he decided to go inside. It appeared that the residence had been burglarized, as chairs were knocked over, a plant had been overturned, a spice rack was knocked over, and there were broken dishes in the kitchen sink. Some powdered cleanser had been spilled on the kitchen floor, and there was a lining of a bare footprint in it. Dill also noticed that one of Jack's most prized possessions, his ceremonial West Point cadet sword and shield, was lying on the floor nearby. In addition, a copy of that book I mentioned earlier, The Long Gray Line, The American Journey of West Point's Class of 1966, was lying open on the kitchen counter. On the surface, it did not appear that anything was stolen, but Dill decided to phone both Jack and Catherine's cell phones and left them voicemails about the situation. After not receiving any response from either of them, Dill decided to inform the police about the break-in the following day. It turned out that Catherine had made repeated attempts to call Jack's cell phone, but they kept going to voicemail, and he never returned her calls. Jack and Catherine had been planning to attend a cousin's wedding on New Year's Eve, but when she couldn't get a hold of them, Catherine went to the wedding alone. Well, at the time she left, Catherine was not yet aware that Jack had been found dead. Shortly before 10 a.m. on the morning of December the 31st, a spotter at the Cherry Island landfill in Wilmington discovered a body on top of a trash heap, and he was soon positively identified as Jack Wheeler. An autopsy would soon discover that Jack suffered a number of serious injuries, including a collapsed lung and broken ribs, as well as severe bruising and swelling to his face and lacerations all over his body. There have also been conflicting accounts about whether or not Jack suffered a heart attack prior to his death. Months later, during an interview in an article with the Wilmington-based newspaper, The News Journal, Catherine said the police kept changing their mind about the heart attack, stating, quote, "First they said he did, then they said he didn't, then they said he did," end quote. Regardless, the medical examiner believed that Jack's injuries were consistent with a beating, ruling that his exact cause of death was blunt force trauma, and the manner of death was listed as homicide. Investigators attempted to backtrack Jack's movements after he left the Nemours building to try and determine how he wound up at the Cherry Island landfill. They eventually spoke to a witness who hailed a taxi cab from Wilmington at around 11 p.m. on December the 30th, which was headed to the town of Newark, located 14 miles away. The witness said that a man matching Jack's description asked to share the cab ride with him when he heard it was going to Newark. While Jack did not have any known connections to Newark, investigators learned that during the early morning hours of December the 31st, a garbage truck driver named Mike Grabowski emptied 10 dumpsters in Newark as part of his trash collection route and subsequently dumped the contents of his load into the Cherry Island landfill. According to Grabowski, it was not uncommon for people to suddenly emerge from dumpsters while his truck was in the midst of lifting them up, as these dumpsters were equipped with side doors which would allow someone to easily climb inside. This led to speculation that Grabowski may have unknowingly transported Jack's body to the landfill, and when forensic testing was performed on the dumpsters from Grabowski's route, it turned up a partial DNA match to Jack in one of them. But the big unanswered question was whether Jack might have climbed into the dumpster himself, possibly to keep warm, or if an unknown third party killed him and placed his body in there. Since Jack still had many valuable items on him when he was found, including some cash, a Rolex watch, and his West Point class ring, it seemed unlikely that robbery was the motive for a potential homicide. Jack's family offered a reward of $25,000, which was later increased to $50,000, for information that led to the arrest of a suspect, and pushed forward the idea that he was murdered due to something connected to his past government work or his current position at the Meter Corporation. In fact, Catherine openly speculated that Jack may have been the victim of a professional hit, stating, quote, "I think perhaps no one has been in on the reward because they've already been paid," end quote. Since Jack's death likely occurred in Newark, the Newark Police Department took over the investigation, but even though the case would be investigated by no less than 10 different agencies, including the FBI, they failed to turn up any promising suspects who might have been responsible for killing Jack. 4 months after his death, Jack's body was cremated, and his remains were interred with full military honors in the Columbarium at Arlington National Cemetery. But after more than a decade, the exact circumstances of how Jack Wheeler was killed remain up for debate. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So this case is something of a reversal of many of the unexplained deaths which have been featured on Unsolved Mysteries. The show has featured a number of cases where someone's death was ruled to be a suicide or an accident, prompting law enforcement to close the case, but their loved ones believe they were the victim of foul play. But judging from the reactions I've seen from online sleuths on various message boards and Reddit, it seems like the majority consensus from those who have watched the Unsolved Mysteries episode is that Jack Wheeler's death was a tragic accident, even though it was officially classified as a homicide, and most of the media coverage of this case has described his death as a murder. Hell, the Unsolved Mysteries episode is literally titled Washington Insider Murder. This is definitely not par for the course when you're talking about online sleuths, who will often gravitate towards theories involving foul play, even if the evidence strongly points towards suicide or accidental death. I mentioned in the intro that before I saw the Unsolved Mysteries episode, my limited knowledge of the case gave me the impression that this was universally considered to be a homicide, and given Jack's previous ties to the US government, you'll definitely find a lot of discussion about his death on conspiracy message boards. But I do wonder if the reaction to this case might be driven by a growing cynicism which has developed within the true crime community towards unsolved mysteries and true crime shows in general, which can sometimes manipulate the facts and leave out key pieces of information in order to suit their narrative. Back when Unsolved Mysteries first launched during the 1980s, there was no internet, and it was more difficult to fact-check the information they shared, so you pretty much took their segments at face value. But these days, it's so much easier to do additional research and find out if a true crime show is distorting the facts. I already talked about this in great detail on the Trail Went Cold episode I released about the death of Ray Rivera. As you probably know, it was featured on the debut episode of the first season of the Unsolved Mysteries reboot, which dropped on Netflix on July 1st, 2020. Ray Rivera was seemingly killed after a fall from the roof of the Belvedere Hotel in Baltimore, Maryland. But even though the authorities ruled Ray's death to be suicide, his loved ones were convinced that he was the victim of foul play. Well, I will admit that I was absolutely captivated by that episode when I originally saw it and had no idea what to think, but it soon became apparent that Unsolved Mysteries left out a lot of information about this story, which may have pointed towards Ray suffering from some sort of mental health crisis and jumping off the roof on his own. Once you looked at the big picture, none of the murder conspiracy theories surrounding this case made much sense, so by the time Unsolved Mysteries dropped their second season in October of 2020, I think the controversy surrounding the presentation of Ray Rivera's death had caused a lot of skepticism to develop about their presentation on Jack Wheeler. Now, I will acknowledge that from a production standpoint, the Washington Insider Murder episode is very well done, and if you watch it for the first time without much prior knowledge of the case, watching the events unfold is pretty compelling. Once the episode ends and you start thinking about some of the possible murder conspiracies, they just don't make much sense at all. A lot of the mystery surrounding this story fades away, and it becomes obvious that Jack's strange actions were the result of his own mental health crisis. The mental health angle in the Ray Rivera case is based on speculation, because he was never officially diagnosed with anything, but we do know that Jack had a long-time struggle with bipolar disorder, and to be fair, Unsolved Mysteries did not shy away from this. While Jack took medication to control his condition, one fact about this case which has never been conclusively established is the last time he took his meds before he died, but if he had been off them for an extended period of time, that would go a long way towards explaining his actions during the last few days of his life, which seemed to indicate that he was having a manic episode. Jack's condition could sometimes make him very energetic and aggressive about issues he was passionate about, and a short time before his death, a moderator at a West Point message board that Jack liked to frequent had to suspend him and give him a timeout because Jack was becoming very temperamental during his postings. Jack had obviously become quite obsessed with preventing construction of the house across the street from his residence at Newcastle, and his neighbor, Robert Dill, claimed that he sometimes had to cut off Jack from going on angry rants and was once chastised by Jack for not being angry enough about the situation. Jack's struggles with depression also took a toll on him, and his wife Catherine once stated, quote, "I don't like to say it, but I think Jack hated himself. He tried to do good all day so he could sleep at night. Then he'd wake up in the morning, and that self-hatred would be there, waiting for him," end quote. According to Jack's family, he also had a terrible sense of direction. It was the type of person who would park his car somewhere and then take a taxi cab home, either because he could not find his vehicle or had completely forgotten he parked it. This totally fits in with the situation where Jack was struggling to find his car inside the parking garage in Wilmington, even though he had parked it in a completely different parking garage 1 week earlier. And I'm sure the whole thing was exacerbated if he was suffering through a manic episode. Another thing which may have helped influence people's interpretation of this case is the release of the controversial true crime documentary series, Crime Scene: The Vanishing of the Cecil Hotel, which came out on Netflix in February of 2021. It chronicled the 2013 death of 21-year-old Elisa Lam, whose body was found inside a water tank on top of the roof of the Cecil Hotel in Los Angeles. The case attained a lot of notoriety in the true crime world due to the release of some security camera footage which showed Elisa behaving erratically inside a hotel elevator shortly before her death, and once this video went viral, there were an endless amount of theories about what happened to her. Well, much like Jack Wheeler, Elisa struggled with bipolar disorder, and you can make a number of parallels between these two cases, since they both involved victims displaying erratic behavior on camera before they wound up dead under odd circumstances. Now, even though I have received numerous requests to cover it, I pretty much decided that I would never do an episode about Elisa Lam, as I always believed that she climbed into the water tank on her own accord, and her death was nothing more than a tragic accident brought on by a mental health crisis. Unlike many other cases of this ilk, Elisa's family has shied away from the spotlight, and do not seem to think that any foul play took place, so in spite of all the endless speculation about her death online, I really did not think there was any crime to solve. I know that a number of people were unhappy when it was announced that Netflix would be releasing a documentary series about this case, and felt they were needlessly exploiting the situation. But after the first three episodes focused on all the wild conspiracy theories surrounding Elisa's death, and innocent people who were falsely accused of murdering her, the final episode ultimately did come to the conclusion that Elisa likely climbed into the water tank on her own while suffering through a manic episode and drowned. So you might be asking, if I was so reluctant to do an episode about Elisa Lam, why am I doing one about Jack Wheeler? Well, the key difference between the two cases is that Jack's death was officially ruled to be a homicide. One of the major criticisms of the Unsolved Mysteries episode is that even though they presented the scenario of Jack's body being loaded from a dumpster into a garbage truck and transported to the landfill, they never acknowledged the possibility that his injuries could have been caused by the truck's trash compactor. It felt like they were intentionally omitting this key detail in order to make their narrative more mysterious, but that doesn't change the fact that the medical examiner and some of the investigators have expressed their belief that his injuries were consistent with a beating. Oddly, it does not seem like law enforcement has ever really acknowledged the trash compactor theory either, so you have to wonder if they have good reason to believe that foul play took place. Well, shortly after the Unsolved Mysteries episode came out, an extensive post was made about this case on the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit by a poster with the greatest username ever, Slut for Bacon. The poster expressed their personal belief that Jack's death was not a homicide, and actually shared a really interesting theory about why this ruling was made. Jack's autopsy was performed relatively quickly, but at the time, the medical examiner had no idea that Jack's body had been loaded from a dumpster into a garbage truck, as it took a couple days for law enforcement to piece together that scenario. Therefore, it was perfectly reasonable for the medical examiner to initially assume that Jack's injuries were the result of a beating, and that an unknown third party was responsible for killing him. Given that Jack had been a prominent and influential person in Washington, his death received a lot of instant media coverage, with much of the reporting referring to it as a murder. This story may be a case study in how the social status of a victim determines how much attention their deaths receives from law enforcement. If a homeless person or a regular citizen had been found under these circumstances, their deaths may have been written off as an accident, and we never would have even heard about them. However, because of who he was, Jack Wheeler was given the benefit of a full-fledged homicide investigation, and even though it does not sound like it has turned up any evidence which points towards a specific suspect, there may be a reluctance to acknowledge that the original homicide ruling might have been wrong, and reclassify Jack's death as an accident. Indeed, there are times when Jack's family have been openly critical about the lack of communication they've received from law enforcement, so you get the impression that they are not even certain where the investigation stands. This is actually not the first tragedy that Jack's wife, Catherine Kleiss, has ever had to experience, because in February of 1995, her sister Emily Kleiss Fisher was murdered after she was stabbed over 50 times inside her home in Memphis, Tennessee. The case remained unsolved for 8 years, until two suspects were finally arrested for Emily's murder, and it turned out she was killed because her son owed his dealer a $20 drug debt, making this about as senseless as a violent crime can get. And believe it or not, in May of 2011, there would be additional drama in Catherine's life when her brother, Henry Kleiss, decided to file a lawsuit in federal court against Catherine and their sister Ellen, accusing them of cyber terror by hacking into the email accounts of himself and his wife and doing whatever they could to disrupt their lives. Even though Jack had been dead for 5 months at this point, he was also named as a defendant in this lawsuit because Henry alleged that Jack used the knowledge of cyber warfare he had gained from working for the government and the Meter Corporation to assist Catherine and Ellen with their harassment. This lawsuit would be settled about 6 months later, but even though Jack was doing work with cybersecurity at the time he died, I think that whole angle, as well as Jack's previous years of service with the government, is nothing but smoke and mirrors. If Jack was the victim of foul play, it most likely came at the hands of a random stranger, as I think the shadowy government conspiracy theories surrounding his death are pretty ridiculous. I know Jack's family has pushed forward the possibility that he was the victim of a professional hit, but the problem is that we have a digital trail tracking a lot of Jack's movements during the last 3 days of his life. He spent this time period traveling around to a number of different locations for inexplicable reasons, but even though there's ample surveillance footage of Jack from various security cameras, at no point does it appear that he's being followed by anyone. It's likely that Jack's death took place in Newark, a town that he didn't have any known ties to or any reason to visit, so how could the killer have known he would be there in the middle of the night? Furthermore, Jack did not have any gunshot or stab wounds on him, so the only way he could have been murdered is if someone beat him to death, which does not seem like the preferred method of execution for a professional assassin. However, if Jack's injuries were consistent with foul play, could it be possible he had a random encounter with someone who administered a fatal beating? Well, let's go back and start at the very beginning. We know that Jack left New York on December the 28th to travel to Washington for work reasons, a decision which did not please his wife, since Catherine thought Jack would be off from Christmas until New Year's, and she said they were planning to spend a few days seeing movies together. However, from what Catherine has said about Jack, I get the impression that he was a bit of a workaholic who had a constant need to feel like he was contributing something to the world and was not the type of person who could just chill out and relax and spend a couple days watching movies. Out of all the victims I've featured on this podcast, I'd say that Jack Wheeler has led one of the most interesting lives and had a number of impressive achievements. He was probably best known for his role in helping create the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, and in fact he was actually portrayed by actor Marshall Colt in the 1988 made-for-TV movie about this story titled To Heal a Nation, which starred Eric Roberts as the founder of the memorial, Jan Scruggs. In fact, when Ronald Reagan visited the memorial later that same year on Veterans Day, it was Jack who introduced him. It sounds like things appeared relatively normal with Jack when he left, but at some point during the day, he decided to leave Washington and travel to his home in Newcastle, and that's where his odd behavior began. Like I mentioned earlier, it's never been established when the last time was that Jack took his medication for bipolar disorder, but if he had suddenly stopped taking it, this would go a long way towards explaining his actions. Even though his neighbor didn't get a good enough look to positively identify him, I think it seems pretty obvious that Jack was the shadowy figure who tossed the smoke bombs at the house, which was under construction, across the street from his residence, particularly since his cell phone was left behind at the scene. It sounds like preventing the construction of his house on that property was one subject that Jack was particularly passionate about, so if he was off his medication and was going through a manic episode, this may have led to an impulsive decision to abandon whatever he was doing in Washington and go to Newcastle for the express purpose of destroying this home. After all, it had only been about 2 weeks since Jack's request for a temporary restraining order against the construction was denied by the court, so he may have figured that burning the whole structure down was his only option, even though those smoke bombs didn't do much damage. It also seems obvious that Jack was responsible for vandalizing his own residence, and while I've never heard any indication that it was positively identified, I'm sure the bare footprint found in the kitchen cleanser likely belonged to Jack. And I think it's interesting that Jack's ceremonial West Point cadet sword and shield were lying on the floor, and the book about his West Point class from 1966 was lying open on the counter, as you get the impression he was taking a few moments to reminisce about the past. Now, in some sources, you'll read that one of Jack's neighbors reported hearing what sounded like the loud noise of a television inside the Wheeler residence in the days prior to Jack's death, even though no one appeared to be home. However, according to his neighbor, Robert Dill, Jack liked to leave the radio on whenever he was absent from the residence in order to give off the false impression that someone was home and possibly discourage potential burglaries from taking place. When Dill checked the residence on December the 30th, he said the radio was no longer playing, so I'm guessing that the noise this other neighbor reported hearing was a radio and not a television, and Jack switched it off at some point when he went inside on the 28th. What's not entirely clear in the timeline is whether Jack tore apart his residence before or after the incident with the smoke bombs. Details are also kind of murky about when exactly police found Jack's cell phone at the scene and traced it back to him. What we do know is that Jack sent an email to his employer the following morning to inform them that his house had been burglarized and that a number of important items, including his briefcase and cell phone, were stolen, yet he never attempted to report this to the police. Given that Jack was very reliant on his cell phone, I'm sure he probably would have become panicky if he dropped it somewhere, particularly if he realized that he left it outside the house across the street and there was no way for him to retrieve it. If Jack believed that the police were going to find the phone and trace it back to him, he may have decided to ransack his house and stage a burglary so that he could present a cover story that his cell phone had been stolen by an unknown party, who subsequently dropped it when they tossed the smoke bombs into the house. Of course, I don't think anyone would have bought that story, but I'm sure Jack was not thinking rationally at that point. One detail about this mystery which has never been solved is what actually did happen to Jack's briefcase, as it was never found. It's possible that Jack simply left it on the train during one of his trips, and that the loss of his briefcase was one of the triggering events which caused his mania to worsen. In fact, I've always wondered if perhaps Jack kept his medication inside the briefcase, which is why he stopped taking it. It's also never been made clear where exactly Jack sent those emails from on the morning of December the 29th, since he no longer had a cell phone at that point, but it's possible that he used a computer at an internet cafe or a library. We do know that Jack was seen at a Newcastle pharmacy at 6 p.m., and since he often had his prescriptions filled at that location, Jack may have instinctively decided to go there if he lost his medication, though all he actually did was ask for a ride to Wilmington. It does seem apparent that something was wrong with Jack at this point, because even though the security footage shows him wearing a suit jacket, he does not have on an overcoat, even though the weather was quite cold. When Jack shows up at the Newcastle County Courthouse parking garage 40 minutes later, he looks to be in even worse shape, since he's now limping and carrying one of his shoes in his hand. Personally, it appears to me in the pharmacy footage that Jack was already limping when he walked inside, but there has been speculation that something could have happened to Jack during that 40-minute window between when he left the pharmacy and arrived at the parking garage. One detail from the Unsolved Mysteries segment which is frustratingly vague is who exactly gave Jack a ride from the pharmacy and where did they take him? Did they drop him off right at the parking garage or take him elsewhere? Well, shortly after the release of this episode, Unsolved Mysteries co-creator Terry Dunn Muir addressed this question during an interview with the website The Wrap, where she confirmed that a man and a woman gave Jack a ride and were not believed to be involved in his disappearance, but the show was unable to track this couple down to interview them or obtain any specific details about Jack's trip. But we know that Jack left his car in a train station parking garage 1 week earlier, so he may have been asked to be dropped off at the courthouse parking garage because he was under the mistaken impression his vehicle was there. It's never been conclusively established where Jack went after he left the garage, but the Unsolved Mysteries segment did say that evidence was found to suggest that Jack spent the night in the basement of the Nemours building, which is where he was seen the following day. The building is a large complex and there are a number of corridors down in the basement area, so I can definitely believe that Jack might have been able to hide out there undetected. We know that Jack visited a law firm at the building named Connolly, Bove, Lodge & Hutz and asked to speak to a managing partner before he left. Even though Jack did not seem to have any apparent connection to that firm, here's a detail which I've only seen mentioned in one source. The Wheeler family did have an attorney named Calm Connolly, who became a spokesperson for them following his death. However, even though Calm Connolly did work in the Nemours building, he was not employed by that particular firm, which was named after an entirely different Connolly. I have to wonder if perhaps Jack wanted to speak to an attorney because he feared there might be legal problems for the incident with the smoke bombs, but he was so disoriented that he went to the wrong law firm. The surveillance footage of Jack wandering around the basement really paints a picture of someone who seems very lost and unsure of what to do. Another point of confusion is that when Jack is filmed leaving the building later that night, he is wearing a hooded sweatshirt which did not belong to him, but there was actually an employee locker room in the basement area, so it's my guess that Jack might have stolen the hoodie from there. The last confirmed sighting of Jack took place at 8:42 p.m., and his body was found just over 12 hours later, but what happened during that window of time is unknown. Given that traces of Jack's DNA were found inside a dumpster in Newark, the theory about a garbage truck collecting his body and transporting it to the Cherry Island landfill is logical, but the big question is how Jack made it to Newark to begin with, since it's about 14 miles away from Wilmington. Well, we have the account from the eyewitness, who believed they shared a taxicab ride to Newark with Jack at around 11:30 p.m., and while the Unsolved Mysteries segment planted the seed that the witness could have been mistaken, I think this would be the best explanation for how Jack got there. Of course, we still have no idea why Jack would want to make a trip to Newark, but given his state of mind at the time, we can't really apply standard logic to his actions. Remember, we have reports of him asking people for a ride to Philadelphia at the Nemours building earlier that day, even though there was no real reason for him to travel there either. So after Jack arrived in Newark, there are two possible explanations for how he died. He climbed into the dumpster himself, possibly to get warm, and was killed by the injury sustained by being picked up by the garbage truck, or he crossed paths with an unknown party who killed him and tossed his body into the dumpster. Even though Jack's official cause of death was blunt force trauma, I guess a third explanation is that he could have suffered a fatal heart attack before he even wound up in the truck, as it sounds like his family has been given conflicting information about whether or not a heart attack took place. His death might have easily have been a combination of heart attack and injuries he sustained, but could the medical examiner have mistaken injuries caused by a garbage truck for injuries caused by a beating? Well, here's a section from a May 2017 article of the Washington Post, written by journalist Steve Volk, who was interviewed during the Unsolved Mysteries segment. It reads, quote, "Connolly hired a private investigator who brought Kleist a theory, which remains popular on the internet, that Wheeler wasn't actually killed. In this scenario, Wheeler sought refuge from the cold in a dumpster and died after the drop into a trash truck. Newark police reject this idea, however, saying the autopsy evidence, which they won't specify for fear of harming the investigation, is entirely consistent with a homicide. Further, a photograph of Wheeler taken after his death, which a friend of the family shared with her permission, shows Wheeler's face and head covered in bruises that appear to be more likely the product of a sustained pummeling than a drop into a trash truck." End quote. Now, admittedly, I haven't seen the original autopsy report since it's never been released publicly, but I can't help but notice that they kept using the phrase "drop into a trash truck" and never actually make mention of the trash compactor. I'd really be curious to know how distinguishable injuries from a drop would be with injuries from a compactor. This whole situation is pretty reminiscent of a high-profile missing persons case from the United Kingdom involving a Royal Air Force Regiment gunner named Corey McKeag, who vanished after leaving a nightclub in Suffolk during the early morning hours in September of 2016. The most common theory in that case is that since McKeag was heavily intoxicated at the time, and there were a number of industrial bins on the route he was last seen walking, he wound up climbing into one before it was picked up by a garbage truck, and McKeag was crushed to death. His body was then taken to a landfill site and dumped there, and while the authorities have performed numerous searches of this landfill and found nothing, there is so much waste there that it's feared McKeag's remains might be irretrievable. So all things considered, Jack Wheeler's family got very lucky that there was a spotter at the Cherry Island landfill who noticed his body right after it was dumped there. Otherwise, it's possible that Jack might still be a missing person to this day, and no one would have any idea what happened to him. The biggest hole in the theory that Jack was the victim of foul play is that he was still wearing valuable jewelry and had cash on him when his body was found, so if robbery was not the motive for his death, what was? If he simply got into an altercation with a random stranger who caused his death, why would they go to the trouble of placing his body in a dumpster? I've even seen a vehicular hit-run accident pushed forward as a potential explanation for Jack's injuries, but again, why would a motorist risk stopping and concealing his body rather than simply fleeing the scene? However, I do have to make a comparison to yet another case with a number of similarities to this one, and that's the 1996 death of Blair Adams, who took an unexplained 4,000-mile cross-country trip from his home in British Columbia before he was found dead in a parking lot in Knoxville, Tennessee. I've previously covered this case on The Trail Went Cold, so you might already know that the circumstances of Blair's death were incredibly bizarre, as he was found nude from the waist down, and thousands of dollars in different currencies were scattered around the scene. Like Jack, Blair had been acting very strangely prior to his death, as he was paranoid that his life was in danger and people were after him, so it seemed apparent he was suffering from some sort of undiagnosed mental health issue. But of course, the key difference is that Blair was killed by a violent blow which ruptured his stomach, something which could not have been self-inflicted, so a third party had to be involved in his death. When you track Blair's movements, it seems very unlikely that someone could have followed him across the continent, which is why I've always suspected that Blair was killed by someone he crossed paths with in Knoxville. Given his erratic behavior, perhaps Blair had an encounter with a completely random stranger and said or did something which prompted this person to deliver a fatal blow to his stomach before fleeing the scene. Theoretically, the same thing could have happened to Jack, as he could have been wandering through the streets of Newark and had an encounter with a stranger who beat him and inflicted the injuries that caused his death. This beating could have been caused by nothing more than Jack saying or doing something to set his attacker or attackers off. Of course, whoever killed Blair Adams left him out in the open and had no concern about concealing his body, which again begs the question about why would anyone bother concealing Jack in a dumpster? But perhaps the answer lies somewhere in the middle. What if someone delivered a severe beating to Jack which was not fatal, and he subsequently crawled into the dumpster to nurse his injuries? For all we know, Jack could have died or passed out before the garbage truck arrived. In essence, maybe the trash compactor or a heart attack was the exact cause of Jack's death, but he still had these noticeable injuries on him from a beating. Under normal circumstances, I would ordinarily go with the explanation that Jack's death was a tragic accident caused by him being loaded into the garbage truck, but I have to reiterate that this isn't one of those cases in which the authorities have closed the investigation because they're confident that no foul play has taken place. They were the ones who classified Jack's death as a homicide and have given off the impression that they believe his injuries were consistent with a beating. But I have to hearken back to the aforementioned theory that the medical examiner could have made this homicide ruling prematurely and misinterpreted Jack's injuries because he had not yet received any information to suggest that Jack had been in a dumpster and a garbage truck. It seemed like the initial impression was that someone had murdered Jack at another location and dumped his body at the landfill on their own accord. And since Jack was such a high-profile figure, there may be a reluctance to admit that the original ruling was wrong and acknowledge that there was no foul play after all. I really hate to say this, but it's possible that this attitude may be the result of the stigma which still surrounds mental illness. For a guy who lived such an interesting, productive life, I think everyone who cared about Jack would have a hard time reconciling the fact that his bipolar disorder caused him to spend the last 3 days of his life wandering around terrified and confused, and his death came about because he crawled into a dumpster to keep warm. It's easier to cling to the idea that Jack was murdered by someone who placed him in that dumpster, because then you would have someone to blame. Losing a loved one to issues that are related to mental illness is so much harder to process, especially when they spend the last moments of their life doing things which don't seem to make any rational sense. Since Ray Rivera was never officially diagnosed with anything, you can understand why his family would believe that his death was the result of some sort of murder conspiracy, rather than him deciding to jump off a roof. All that being said, I have not seen Jack Wheeler's autopsy report, and I assume that there are a lot of key pieces of information that the authorities have never released publicly. If they legitimately have good reason to believe that Jack was the victim of foul play, I would be more than happy to be proven wrong by seeing an arrest someday. However, I do find it encouraging that ever since the release of the Unsolved Mysteries episode, most of the online discussions I've seen about this case have focused more on the issue of mental health rather than over-the-top conspiracy theories. For many cold cases, the opposite is true, So I'm taking this as a sign that people are open to considering and discussing mental health, so there's less of a stigma attached to it. Regardless of whether his death was an accident or a murder, Jack Wheeler deserves to be best remembered for the many things he achieved in life, such as the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, rather than the circumstances of how he died. But if you happen to have any information about the death of Jack Wheeler which points to a homicide, please contact the Delaware Crime Stoppers at 1-800-TIP-3333. That's 1-800-847-3333. Or you can submit a tip through their website at DelawareCrimeStoppers.com. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I actually recorded a special bonus episode with Charlie, host of the Crime Lines podcast, in which we discussed a bizarre missing children's case from Spain involving the disappearance of 10-year-old Juan Pedro Martinez Gomez. In addition, we've dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss another classic case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1987 disappearance of Dale Kerstetter. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Hannon and Stacy H. Thank you so much for your support. I'm also pleased to announce that The Trail Went Cold has been added to the lineup for Podcast Row at 2 CrimeCon events this year. So provided that it is safe enough to travel, I will be appearing at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held at Paris and Bally's in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets, we already have our own personalized promo code to receive a 10% discount off a standard badge. Please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. I'm also hoping to appear at CrimeCon UK, being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on June the 11th and 12th. If you would like to get a 10% discount on tickets to this event, please visit crimecon.co.uk and use the promo code COLE22. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, which, like I mentioned earlier, has a very interesting thread containing discussion about the Jack Wheeler case. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the ear music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶